It was torturous the last time. I won't play it every week, but particularly inclined today. There's some late breaking news. A Catholic charity that was just about to distribute baby food, The Warehouse, was just struck this morning, according to NPR. I'm sure they had all their permits, et cetera, et cetera. Ghastly. I saw also something, I can't actually remember where I saw it, I think it was Middle East Eye, that despite the scorching heat in Israel, Palestine, all through the Middle East, there was a video of IDF, Israeli military, pouring concrete into a wellhead to seal. I think it was in Gaza, but it might have been in the West Bank, because the savagery is everywhere. And now Bibi has said Eretz Israel, sure, parts of Jordan, parts of Syria. They already have a virtual occupation of some Syrian territory right next to a big hydroelectric plant, by the way. Doesn't get much coverage here. I think I mentioned it. Maybe you covered it. I don't know. Amy Goodman probably had. So the first feature is a replay of yesterday's so-called debate. It wasn't really kind of a debate, but it did explore a lot of issues around the deal, the non-deal deal, whatever. He didn't give away the store. That's the discourse in most of the liberal media, it seems. Whatever that means. I'm looking at the latest Public Eye, where I have an article about the mini modular nuclear plant that U of I has signed a contract to build right next to a railroad track on Abbott Power Plant, right in the middle of town, urging you to contact the new chancellor and say, maybe test it outside of town first. They're supposed to be cute and modular and movable. Anyway, I don't have a whole lot of time for discourse, because it is a pretty tight show. Both Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia is a stringer for WHYY, which produces Fresh Air, which never has done a really good show on the Mumia case because they're too scared, even in the older days, to give a, quote, cop killer a coverage. But I'm also highlighting an article from a couple of years ago. I don't write often, but I think I picked some pretty good subjects. And that was about the backstory to the conflict in Ukraine. I called it U.S.-Russia proxy war. In retrospect, I guess I should have titled it Pawns of Imperial Battle or something like that, because the people that have lost their lives partially because of neocon intransigence with the European, what was it called? It's called the Minsk process, but it actually, there were meetings also in Normandy, so I've been calling it the Minsk-Normandy process, was sabotaged by neocons, particularly Robert Kagan's wife, Victoria, drawing a barren fate on her name. All right, well, that's enough time. That's more than enough time. So let's kick it with the Mumia commentary. I may actually run out of time to play Masters of War, which I wanted to get to, because for the first time in decades, Dylan has played it as a concert. It's one of the most wrenching folk songs you could ever hear. And hope to get to a few bars of it. First, speaking of folk music, here's Kevin Elliott's Enterprise. He's on Tuesdays doing folk music, but the other thing he does is counseling, working with people on their problems.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Elliott Counseling Group, who offers compassionate mental health care to individuals of all ages. Elliott Counseling Group serves Central Illinois with in-person and online sessions. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com. That's E-L-L-I-O-T-T, Counseling Group, no punctuation or spaces.com, or by phone at 217-398-9066.
And that's read by Rick Ebenshaw, who does the Wednesday Beat Blender, and he's the editor extraordinaire for the Public Eye and some other journals, actually, I found out. Here's Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentary on the targeted assassination of a major journalist along with, three or four colleagues?
We've heard just hours ago, just moments ago, actually, about the killing of Anas al-Sharif, a correspondent for Al Jazeera, who was killed in Gaza in a tent with four colleagues. This was called, proudly, by the Israeli Offense Force, a targeted assassination. And they claimed that he was a hidden member of Hamas. As for his four colleagues, well, they don't count. They were with him. And for being with him, this brave and talented journalist was slain with six other journalists. Being a journalist in occupied Palestine is a capital offense, it appears. Telling the world about how Zionists are killing children and women and old men trying to get a mouthful of bread in this mass starvation event is a capital offense. Telling people what is happening in their homeland is a capital offense. What about free press? What about the right of journalists to tell the stories about the communities in which they live and where they suffer and where they die? I don't want to hear about a First Amendment. I don't want to hear crowing by corporate media that knows how to bend its knee and bow to fake kings, but cannot tell the story of the suffering of nearly a million people. I am deeply proud to share my voice on behalf of Anas al-Sharif and his colleagues, and for the struggle in Palestine, which moves us, even though we're miles and miles away, and united by the beats of our hearts. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast.
If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice.
Those were the words circulated on X and voiced on air by Al Jazeera of Anas al-Sharif, a 28-year-old journalist in Gaza, after he was killed in an Israeli airstrike August 10th. Anticipating his own death, he wrote his statement last April.
I have lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times. Yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that God may bear witness against those who stayed silent and accepted our killing. Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance.
Anas al-Sharif, a correspondent for Al Jazeera Arabic, was one of the most prominent journalists still working in northern Gaza, covering Israel's ongoing siege and assault. He was killed along with his fellow Al Jazeera correspondent Mohammed Kreka, cameraman Ibrahim Zahar and Mohammed Nufal, and freelance media workers Mohamed Aliwa and Mohammed Al-Khaldi, when Israel bombed their press tent located just outside Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. The Israeli military released a statement confirming its responsibility for the attack, falsely claiming al-Sharif was a Hamas cell leader. Israel had long been threatening Anas al-Sharif, prompting Irene Khan, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, to issue a statement on July 31st, just 10 days before al-Sharif's assassination. The statement read in part, quote, "Online attacks and unfounded accusations by the Israeli army against Al Jazeera journalist Anas al-Sharif are a blatant attempt to endanger his life and silence his reporting on the genocide in Gaza," unquote. Al-Sharif had been targeted since the start of Israel's assault on Gaza in October 2023. Speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, 2 days after the murder of Anas al-Sharif and the other journalists and media workers, Irene Khan said,
"Anas actually contacted me, and Al Jazeera contacted me to tell me of this impending threat on his head. They had seen it before. He's not the first one, as you know. There are some, anything between 26 to 30 journalists who have been targeted in this campaign of assassination. And Anas wanted me to go public. He wanted others to go public to stop what Israel was doing."
Mohammed Mouawad, Al Jazeera's managing editor, told Democracy Now!,
"The pattern is clear. Degrading, delegitimizing, smearing, and then killing, justifying the killing by unfounded allegations. Anas and Mohammed were the voices you heard from Gaza's shattered streets, the steady tone that made chaos comprehensible. Mohammed and Anas were the eye behind the lens, catching all the details to the world from Gaza City. They were the only two prominent voices left in Gaza."
The timing of the assassination is key. They were among the last journalists in northern Gaza prepared to report at enormous personal risk on Israel's renewed invasion of Gaza City to depopulate the city of 1 million Palestinians, forcing them farther south. Since October 2023, Israel's banned the international press from Gaza. On Sunday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed reporters at a news briefing, saying,
"I've ordered and directed the military to bring in foreign journalists, more foreign journalists, a lot."
Of course, if allowed in, reporters who embed with the IDF will be restricted in what they see, and their coverage released only after being approved by Israel's military censors. Addressing the reporters, Netanyahu added,
"There's a problem with assuring security, but I think it can be done in a way that is responsible and careful to preserve your own safety."
Hours later, the Israeli military murdered the Al Jazeera team. Israel's attack on Gaza has been the most deadly conflict for journalists and media workers in the modern era, anywhere in the world, with over 200 killed since October 2023, with others injured or arrested. Palestinian journalists face similar risks of Israeli military and settler violence in the occupied West Bank, as evidenced by the army's targeted killing of Al Jazeera's renowned correspondent Shireen Abu Akleh, a U.S. citizen, in Jenin on May 11, 2022.
"Anas and Mohammed's voices aren't silenced,"
Al Jazeera's Mohammed Mouawad said.
"The truth that they have been carrying to the world since the beginning of the war would echo in our coverage. We will continue the coverage."
Israel's violence against journalists is just one component of the ethnic cleansing underway in Gaza. None of the violence would be possible without the ongoing support of the U.S. government. It's crucial that U.S. media workers join their colleagues around the world, demanding unfettered access for international journalists into Gaza, an immediate end to Israel's killing of Palestinian journalists, and that those responsible be held accountable. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah. Okay, and now I'm going to replay her discussion with Juan Gonzalez as well, with Matt Duss, former advisor to Bernie Sanders, and Jim Professor Mearsheimer from the University of Chicago, who is called a realist in the division of political science people. He always corrects that and say he's a tragic realist. He's not happy about the realistic situation, but I don't know. Influenced me a lot. He had some videos, YouTube videos, that were seen by millions, so there must be some dissident views out and about. As I mentioned at the top, I wrote a piece that quotes him some for the local public eye on the whole situation and the U.S. role in stifling a solution referred to earlier as the Minsk-Normandy process. The end of it would have likely have possibly been, wasn't tested because the U.S. scuttled it. Victoria Nuland was the forgettable State Department person. It took all the way, and it's halfway through Biden's term to get her out of a State Department position. She was in the Obama State Department. That's where she said the famous blank the EU at the time of the Maidan uprising and the, I believe, hijacking of the same by really reactionary forces. I have some evidence to that in the article. So this is quite wide-ranging, and it deserves a part two, but she hasn't done it yet. Maybe she will after things develop a little bit. Obviously, there was really nothing to report on in the Anchorage detail except for how much both of those chaps like pomp and circumstance, apparently. Just not a very substantive discussion. So this was recorded Friday live, so before a lot of the discourse, which, again, it's not that important because nothing substantial went down, just a lot of P.T. Barnum kind of stuff. I don't know. It's not the right expression, but okay, here's the discussion. It's worth listening to closely. And then I'm going to follow up with a long segment about the news of the week from Gaza. And so fortify yourself. You can listen to it at Flashpoints, archived on the Friday edition of Dennis Bernstein's show.
Putin doesn't agree to a ceasefire deal. Meanwhile, Zelensky's rejected proposals for Ukraine to give up territory in the Donbas region as part of a ceasefire. Today's summit is taking place in Alaska, which the United States purchased from Russia in 1867. The meeting marks Putin's first visit to the United States since 2015, when he met with President Obama during the United Nations General Assembly. Trump and Putin last met in 2019 at the G20 in Japan. Today's summit's taking place even though there's an outstanding warrant from the International Criminal Court seeking Putin's arrest for war crimes involving the unlawful transfer of children from occupied areas of Ukraine. Neither Russia nor the U.S. is a party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC. This all comes as Russian forces claim to have captured two more settlements in Ukraine's eastern Donbas region, while Ukraine ordered the mandatory evacuation of families from a town close to where Russian forces recently broke through front lines. To talk more about the war in Ukraine, U.S.-Russian relations and more, we're joined by two guests in Washington, D.C. Matt Duss is with us, Executive Vice President at the Center for International Policy, former foreign policy advisor to Senator Bernie Sanders. And John Mearsheimer joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mearsheimer is professor of political science at the University of Chicago and author most recently of How States Think, The Rationality of Foreign Policy. In 2014, he wrote a widely read piece for Foreign Affairs headlined, Why the Ukraine Crisis is the West's Fault. Well, Professor Mearsheimer, let's begin with you. Talk about what's happening today in Alaska and what your view is of Trump's relationship with Putin and Zelensky and what needs to happen now.
Very much wants a peace agreement. He wants to shut down the Ukraine war. But the fact is that he's not able to do that. And meeting in Alaska with Putin today is not going to do anything to help achieve that end. And the principal problem here, Amy, is that the Russians have a series of demands that they will not compromise on, that Trump cannot accept, and certainly the Ukrainians won't accept, and the Europeans won't accept. And those three demands involve the West and Ukraine recognizing that Russia has annexed four Ukrainian oblasts and the Crimea. That's number one. Number two is the Russians insist that Ukraine be a neutral state. This basically means it can't be in NATO and it can't have security guarantees from the West, especially the United States. And then the third demand is that Ukraine disarm to the point where it doesn't have significant offensive capability against Russia. These demands are unalterable from a Russian perspective, but obviously they're unacceptable to the Ukrainians, they're unacceptable to the Europeans, and there's no way that Trump can agree to them. So there'll be a lot of talking today about a lot of issues, but I find it hard to imagine you're going to make any progress towards an agreement.
And Professor Mearsheimer, the mere fact that this summit is between Trump and Putin, doesn't that in effect reinforce the perspective of some that this has essentially been a proxy war between the United States and Russia from the beginning?
Oh, it's clearly been a proxy war, and there's no question that the United States and Russia are almost at war with each other. And therefore, it makes sense for Putin and for Trump to sit down and talk and try to work out the broad parameters of a deal. But the problem is there are two other players in the game, and those two other players are Ukraine and Europe. So you have a situation here, Juan, where even if Putin and Trump were to work out some sort of agreement, they could lay out the parameters of a deal. They have to run that deal by the Ukrainians and the Europeans. And I think if Trump makes the necessary concessions to accommodate the Russians, the problem is that there's no way the Ukrainians, the Europeans, and truth be told, a large chunk of the American national security establishment would accept the deal that Putin worked out. And that's why this one is ultimately going to be settled on the battlefield.
I'd like to bring in Matt Dust to the conversation. Matt, your perspective on this summit in Alaska and what you expect or think may come out of it.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, in terms of what's going to come out of this summit, I actually don't disagree with Professor Mearsheimer. It seems like there's not been a great deal of preparation going into this summit. And Putin, as the professor said, Putin's goals do not seem to have changed much, if at all. He wants a Ukraine that's effectively under his influence, part of Russia's sphere of control. That's not something the Ukrainians are going to agree with. I think we can imagine a possible resolution to this in which Russia retains control of parts of Ukraine. I think there is some evidence that Ukrainians themselves would settle for that if it really ended the war. And I think that's the key question here. Can we get an agreement that ends the war, not just temporarily, but in the long term? And I think that's very, very unlikely, at least right now. Although I will say, just the fact that the U.S. and Russia are sitting down could possibly create some other opportunities that we haven't yet considered, although I'm very skeptical.
I want to put this question to both Matt Dust and Professor Mearsheimer, because I know that you disagree on this issue, is how did we get to this point? Let's start with you, Matt.
Well, we got to this point because Vladimir Putin decided to invade Ukraine and try to take it over. There's a longer history there, of course. I mean, Professor Mearsheimer has talked a lot about the growth of NATO and how Russia sees that as a threat. I think there is evidence that that is true. I mean, that others have claimed that as well. U.S. officials throughout the 1990s, former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry, former head of the CIA Bill Burns, have all in their time as diplomats mentioned that this is a real problem for Russia, not just for Putin. However, that does not explain the entire problem. NATO alone was not the cause of this war. Putin himself has made clear various times, most notably in a speech that he gave in June 2021, of his much grander vision of a kind of restored Russian imperium in which Ukraine was a part. So I think the growth of NATO, again, is part of Russia's larger grievance. But I do think Putin has made clear that he has a pretty grandiose historical conception of what he sees as a kind of renewed Russian empire that is simply not consistent, certainly with Ukraine's own sovereignty and independence. And I don't think it's consistent with a kind of a general approach to international affairs that is based in any kind of law or norms.
Professor Mearsheimer.
I think, Amy, before I give you my explanation on what caused the war, it's very important to understand that how you think about the causes of the war has huge implications for how you think about the prospects for actually settling the conflict. Now, Matt basically makes the argument that the principal cause of the war was that Putin had grand ambitions. He wanted to restore the Soviet Union, create a greater Russia or what have you. And he was interested in conquering Ukraine and incorporating it into Russia. I don't believe that. I believe there's hardly any evidence to support that line of argument. And I think it's quite clear. In fact, I think there's overwhelming evidence that it was NATO expansion into Ukraine that drove this train. Putin made it clear when NATO first announced in April 2008 that Ukraine would become part of NATO. Putin made it perfectly clear that he viewed this as an existential threat, and this would not be allowed to happen. And the invasion on February 24th, 2022, was driven in large part by fear of NATO expansion. And what that means is that Putin sees NATO expansion. He sees Ukraine and NATO as an existential threat. And because he sees it as an existential threat, he's unwilling to compromise. Many people think that in Alaska, what Trump can do is work out a deal where there's a territorial swap, where there's a ceasefire to start with, and so forth and so on, and the Russians will make this accommodation and that accommodation. That's not true. The Russians have laid out their demands from the very beginning. They have not wavered at all. And the reason they have not wavered is because they view Ukraine in NATO as an existential threat. We, on the other hand, in the West, don't see things that way. We think that Putin was just aggressive. He didn't get all he wanted, but we can work out a deal with him. I don't think that is an accurate description of reality. I think, again, you want to understand that Ukraine has to be a neutral state. There can be no Ukraine in NATO. There can be no Western security guarantees to Ukraine. But we refuse to accept that. The Ukrainians refuse to accept that. And that's why we're at an impasse today.
Matt Duss, I wanted to ask you, back in the 2013 and 2014, on Democracy Now!, we had the Russia expert Stephen Cohen on many times, and he essentially said the same thing. In fact, he insisted that the president who was overthrown, Yanukovych, wanted to maintain the neutrality in the Maidan revolt in 2014, wanted to maintain the neutrality of Ukraine. But it was NATO that was insisting that Ukraine could not be neutral and that had to take a stand against Russia. And that's part of what then led to his overthrow that the United States clearly backed. Wondering your sense of that. And also, do you think that if Mexico reached a security agreement with China or Russia, stationed troops from those countries in its own country or missiles from those countries in Mexico, that the United States would sit idly by?
Sure. I mean, all good questions. I mean, first, I want to just respond to something Professor Mearsheimer said. I mean, it's baffling to hear him claim that there's no evidence that Putin wanted to conquer Ukraine and establish a new kind of Russian imperium. Putin has said this explicitly. I would encourage people to look at that June 2021 speech that I mentioned. He also, landed troops outside Kyiv in February 2022 as part of the failed effort to topple Ukraine's government and install his, a friendly Russian government. Those Russian troops were not landed in Kyiv to go camping. So that effort failed, but I think that's clear evidence that Putin's ambitions were much larger than the professor seems to claim. Now, with regard to the Maidan and Yanukovych, I don't think I would put this on NATO. Clearly, as I said, Russia and Putin have seen the growth of NATO as a threat. I think we should take that seriously. That's something we need to discuss. I would also note that countries are not absorbed into NATO. Countries in Europe have sought to join NATO. This is not something that is being imposed on them. They see joining NATO as part of their security. Again, that's not to diminish, I think, the kind of the way that Russia sees this as provocative. I do think we need to take that seriously. But the Maidan Revolution was not about NATO. The Maidan Revolution was about the people of Ukraine seeking closer relationships with Europe rather than closer relationships with Russia. And I think it's important to note that this is not something that was driven by NATO. This was something that was driven by the Ukrainian people. And I think this constant obsession with NATO really denies Ukrainians their own agency. And I think we need to put that really at the center of this conversation. Now, your question about Mexico, clearly, if Mexico was to sign a security agreement with Russia or China or any other power, the United States would probably have something to say about it. I think that's something we should work through diplomatically. That would not, in my view, justify the United States invading and occupying parts of Mexico in response.
I want to talk about what Ukrainians want. First, going to Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, speaking to reporters during a joint briefing in Berlin with a German chancellor, Friedrich Merz.
We must prepare a trilateral format for the conversation. There must be a ceasefire, number one. There must be really reliable security guarantees. Today, by the way, President Trump spoke about supporting this and about America's readiness to participate. Also, among the agreed principles, Russia cannot have a veto right over Ukraine's European and NATO prospects. And peace talks should be combined with appropriate pressure on Russia. Sanctions must be in place, and they must be strengthened if Russia does not agree to a ceasefire in Alaska.
Let me go to Professor Mearsheimer first and point out that there was just this Gallup poll. More than 3 years into the war, Ukrainian support for continuing to fight until victory has hit a new low. In Gallup's most recent poll of Ukraine, conducted in early July, 69% say they favor a negotiated end to the war as soon as possible, compared with 24% who support continuing to fight until victory. Let's go back to 2022. Three quarters, 73% in Ukraine, favored Ukraine fighting until victory. Let's get your response, Professor, and then Matt Das.
Well, I think it's not surprising that enthusiasm for the war in the Ukrainian body politic has diminished. They've suffered enormous casualties. The Russians have been winning on the battlefield, and it doesn't look like Ukraine can rescue the situation or that the West can help Ukraine rescue the situation. So obviously, down below in Ukrainian society, support for the war is beginning to melt away. The problem is that at the elite level, there's no evidence that anyone is willing to cut a deal with the Russians. And again, you want to understand that the Russians are driving a hard bargain here. They're driving a really hard bargain. It will be extremely difficult, and I'm choosing my words carefully here, for any Ukrainian leader to accept the terms that the Russians have on the table and don't show any flexibility with regard to. Now, what the Ukrainian elites are hoping they can do is they're hoping that they can drag the Americans and they can drag the Europeans into giving meaningful security guarantees to Ukraine for the future, and that they will continue, the West will continue to support Ukraine, and that at some point in the future, Russia will weaken and Ukraine will be in a position with help from the West to get territory that it's now lost back from Russia. That's their great hope. So the elites are willing to hang in there. And this is what you see reflected in Zelensky's comments. But the question you have to ask yourself, Amy, is what is going to happen to Ukraine in this war as it continues to lose on the battlefield and support at home melts away? One would think at some point Ukraine will collapse. Given historical evidence, that is the likely outcome.
Matt Das, do you agree?
Yeah, I do pretty much agree, except I would not put so much on Ukraine's elites. Clearly, there are some in the Ukrainian government, who fit the characterization that the professor just made. But I think what's important here to note is that there is growing support among Ukrainians, as you noted, to end this war. If you could have a durable and real end to the war, I don't think we should, with regard to President Zelensky's comments, I don't think anyone should be surprised. I don't think anyone should expect the president of Ukraine to kind of preemptively concede territory. I do think that if there was an offer or an agreement in the works that really ended the war, the government of Ukraine could probably be, pressured into agreeing to it. They understand there is political support in the country, even though it will be a very, very tough decision to accept a large part of their country is now under the control of Russia. But again, the key question here is, has Putin changed his ultimate goal? And there is no evidence that Putin is willing to enter such an agreement that really ends the war. That is the key problem here.
And Professor Mearsheimer, I wanted to ask you a couple of facts that are startling to me. When the Soviet Union collapsed in the early 1990s and Ukraine became independent, Ukraine had a population of 52 million people. By the time the war started with Russia, the population was already down to 40 million. And today, the estimates are, given the out-migration, the refugees that have left, the continuing high death rate and low birth rate, that there's only about 28 million people in the current Ukraine. This is an astonishing decline of population for a country. Has Ukraine essentially been a country that's been disintegrating ever since the fall of the Soviet Union?
Well, let me make two points on this. First of all, the phrase is sometimes used to describe the situation in Ukraine that it is in a demographic death spiral. Think about those words. It's in a demographic death spiral. And what this war has done is ended up killing huge numbers of Ukrainians. And furthermore, huge numbers of Ukrainians have left the country. And I would surmise that many of them will not return. So this is a disaster from a demographic point of view.
We just have 30
seconds,
Professor.
Is if you look. Sorry. Ukraine is going to end up as a dysfunctional rump state as well. And this is a disaster of great proportions.
What do you think in 15 seconds? How do you think this should end?
I think it should end with the Ukrainians doing everything they can to concede to the Russians and put an end to the war. I don't think they're going to get a better deal if
and
they
Matt
fight
does.
On.
10 seconds.
I think the best thing to do is cut it now.
I would agree. I wrote a piece with my colleague Rob Farley back in November for Foreign Policy magazine saying this was the time for the Ukrainians to get to make the best peace they can, basically saying that if they can concede part of Ukraine that Russia now controls, they should do it. But the question is, will that really end the war? And the problem is we see no evidence.
Well, that's what they debate, the no evidence. They have the same prescription, which is to make the deal. So that was from yesterday's Democracy Now! John Mearsheimer has a free but upgradable Substack. Trump stumbles towards Alaska. Trump EU leaders and Zelensky summit road to nowhere. There's also one called North to Alaska. So, yeah, opinions you hear are those of the speakers, of course, and barely enough time to get the news from Gaza. In the West Bank, actually, but I think most of it will be from Gaza. This is from Nahar Barros Friedman, who works with Ali Abu Nima. He's still in Chicago, though I haven't heard much from him. This is actually excerpted from Friday's Flashpoints from the Electronic Intifada page. And yeah, just enough time probably to get this on. The last week's was a excruciating scene of torture. Testimony from a youth who was tortured extensively. I'm looking at Medea Benjamin, who says 79% of Israeli Jews say Gaza's famine doesn't trouble them. Okay, I'm extremely troubled, and I already gave a disclaimer, so got a replay of the tribute to Bob Polesny that was on the Radio Free Labor a month or so ago, because Gus had to actually go away in August. He said he was going to be here through the whole time, but not the case. So perhaps I'll try and listen to some of that again, too. That's painful for me as well, still missing him. So I probably won't have time for Masters of War or this other blues song that I was going to dedicate to him. How about that?
Latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has bombed and attacked areas across Gaza this week, killing at least 564 Palestinians and injuring nearly 3,100 between August 6th and August 13th, according to official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. The number of casualties among starving people trying to access food aid has increased to nearly 1,900 killed and approximately 13,600 injured since May 27th. When Israel and the U.S. opened its private so-called aid distribution sites, opening fire on crowds every day since. On Wednesday, Israeli forces killed at least 100 Palestinians, the health ministry reported, including 61 in attacks in Gaza City, as Israel's destruction of northern Gaza intensifies. 37 starving people were killed on Wednesday while trying to obtain food aid. An airstrike in the Zeytun neighborhood of Gaza City on August 11th killed an entire family, the only survivor being a young girl named Loreen An-Nadim, who was trapped beneath the rubble, pinned against a mattress that Loreen said was her parents' bed. The Palestinian Civil Defense recorded her rescue. That's from the Civil Defense on August 11th. Their spokesperson, Mahmoud Basal, said that air raids on Gaza City have been steadily intensifying for days, as the Israeli army is using bombs, drones, and highly explosive munitions that cause massive destruction to residential buildings. The Civil Defense stated earlier this week that one of its firefighters was killed in his family's tent shelter in Al-Mawasi in central Gaza. More than 135 rescue workers with the Civil Defense have been killed over the past 22 months. Israel's escalations of attacks in Gaza City this week killed at least 7 children in a single airstrike on a building in the Zeytun neighborhood on Sunday, August 10th. In an extremely graphic video, the bodies of 7 small children, most of whom appear to be babies and toddlers, lay bloodied and strewn on the floor at a hospital as family members mourned over them. Later that evening on August 10th, Israel directly attacked a journalist's tent in the courtyard of El Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, assassinating 6 broadcast reporters and photojournalists as Israel's hunting and targeted killings of high-profile witnesses to its crimes of genocide continue with impunity. Al Jazeera's Anas Al-Sharif, a 28-year-old reporter who millions in Palestine and around the world relied on every day for his coverage, was killed alongside the network's correspondent Mohamed Kareka, their cameramen Ibrahim Zahir and Mohamed Nofal, journalists Mu'amin Aliwa and Mohamed Al-Khaldi, and Saad Jundia, a Palestinian civilian who happened to be present. This clip was recorded just moments after the airstrike, when friends and colleagues of the reporters and their community realized that they had been killed. They tried to retrieve the journalists' shredded bodies as their clothes were still on fire. That was filmed just moments after the airstrike on the journalist's tent at Al-Shifa Hospital. Just 3 weeks ago, Anas Al-Sharif's appeal to all international press freedom and human rights organizations to do something to intervene against renewed threats against him by the Israeli military. He stated on July 23rd, quote, "Once again, the Israeli army spokesperson has launched a campaign of threats and incitement against me because of my work as a journalist with Al Jazeera. I reaffirm I, Anas Al-Sharif, am a journalist with no political affiliations. My only mission is to report the truth from the ground, as it is, without bias." Al-Sharif's friend and fellow reporter Ibrahim Nofal, whose brother Mohammed was killed in the airstrike on August 10th, had filmed Anas Al-Sharif reacting to the video of Israeli military spokesperson Avichai Adrai, who openly threatened Al-Sharif on social media. Anas watches the video on a phone, in a tent, surrounded by his colleagues. He says, quote, "I really don't know, Ibrahim, what this guy wants from me. He wants me to stop covering the news. He wants me to stop covering the massacres that are happening. Despite that, I will continue until my last breath. Whether he threatens me or wants to bomb me, the mission will continue until the last breath, God willing. God willing, we are not afraid." Anas Al-Sharif and his colleagues who were murdered on August 10th in their tent at Al-Shifa Hospital are 6 of at least 238 reporters and media workers killed by the Israeli army as the world powers and international agencies continue to fail the Palestinians of Gaza nearly 2 years into this genocide. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said that Israel, quote, has turned its horrific 22-month war on the Gaza Strip into a slaughterhouse for Palestinian journalists, systematically targeting them and their workplaces in an effort to enforce a total media blackout across the enclave. Anas Al-Sharif's final broadcast for Al Jazeera aired earlier in the day, focused on tiny children who were suffering from Israel's deliberate starvation policy. Al-Sharif, wearing his press vest and helmet, reported from a Gaza City hospital and told the stories of each child in the ward in a harrowing 4-minute report. Later that evening, Al-Sharif posted the following, quote, The occupation is threatening to invade Gaza seriously, and the city has been bleeding for 22 months under the fire of land, sea, and air. Its martyrs number in the tens of thousands, and its wounded in the hundreds of thousands. And if this madness does not stop, nothing will remain of Gaza but rubble, and the image and voice of its people will fade away, and history's memory will record you as silent witnesses to a genocide crime that no one did anything to stop. Minutes before he was killed, Anas al-Sharif posted 13 seconds of video of heavy bombing in Gaza City. He captioned this clip, quote, "Relentless bombardment. For 2 hours, the Israeli aggression has intensified on Gaza City." Two days earlier, on Friday, August 8th, Anas al-Sharif documented an airstrike on homes in western Gaza City while he was being hunted by the Israelis and while the Israeli government announced that they were planning to intensify their obliteration of northern Gaza. Quote, "Night and day, the Israeli raids on Gaza do not stop," he wrote. "And this is one of them, just moments ago, targeting a house west of Gaza City." In April of this year, just days after Israel assassinated his colleague, 23-year-old Hossam Shabat, in a targeted drone strike, Anas al-Sharif wrote his last will and testament to be published upon his death. I'll read excerpts of it here. "This is my will and my final message. If these words reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. God knows I gave every effort and all my strength to be a support and a voice for my people ever since I opened my eyes to life in the alleys and streets of the Jabalia refugee camp. My hope was that God would extend my life so I could return with my family and loved ones to our original town of occupied Ascalon, Al-Majdal. But God's will came first and his decree is final. I have lived through pain in all its details, tasted suffering and loss many times, yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that God may bear witness against those who stayed silent, those who accepted our killing, those who choked our breath, and whose hearts were unmoved by the scattered remains of our children and women, doing nothing to stop the massacre that our people have faced for more than a year and a half. I entrust you with Palestine, the jewel in the crown of the Muslim world, the heartbeat of every free person in this world. I entrust you with its people, with its wronged and innocent children who have never had the time to dream or live in safety and peace. Their pure bodies were crushed under thousands of tons of Israeli bombs and missiles, torn apart and scattered across the walls. I urge you not to let chains silence you, nor borders restrain you. Be bridges toward the liberation of the land and its people until the sun of dignity and freedom rises over our stolen homeland. I entrust you to take care of my family. I entrust you with my beloved daughter Shem, the light of my eyes, whom I never got the chance to watch grow up as I had dreamed. I entrust you with my dear son Salah, who I had wished to support and accompany through life until he grew strong enough to carry my burden and continue the mission. I entrust you with my beloved mother, whose blessed prayers brought me to where I am, whose supplications were my fortress, and whose light guided my path. I also entrust you with my lifelong companion, my beloved wife, Salah Bayan, from whom the war separated me for many long days and months. Yet she remained faithful to our bond, steadfast as the trunk of an olive tree that does not bend, patient, trusting in God, and carrying the responsibility in my absence with all her strength and faith. I urge you to stand by them, to be their support after God Almighty. If I die, I die steadfast upon my principles. Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance." Condolences and messages of grief and love poured in from Anas al-Sharif's colleagues, from friends, and from people across Gaza and around the world. Reporter Ahmed al-Najjar in Khan Yunis told Al Jazeera on Tuesday that the targeted airstrike on the agency's staff was the most devastating loss Gaza's journalist community has faced. Journalist Salah al-Jafarawi mourned Anas al-Sharif and posted this video of their reunion during the so-called ceasefire in January of this year. That was from journalist Salah al-Jafarawi. Anas al-Sharif, 28 years old, was buried in Gaza City along with his colleagues. Mohamed Koreka, a correspondent for Al Jazeera who was also killed in the airstrike on the reporter's tent at Al-Shifa Hospital, was the only son of his parents. In 2024, Israeli forces executed his mother, who sought shelter and medicine at Al-Shifa Hospital during the second assault on the compound, according to his colleague Nur Oda. Mohamed was killed a few steps away from the crime scene of his mom's murder, Oda said. Koreka was described by his wife as extremely devoted to his mother, to his children, and to her. Quote, "We were unnaturally close," she said. "He spent his time between his work and his home. He dedicated his life to his wife and children." Hamid and Anas had a very strong relationship, but we never expected them to meet the same end. Meanwhile, as Israel slaughters professional eyewitnesses to its crimes, Western and regional states continue to send lethal airdropped parcels of food aid instead of forcing Israel to open the crossings to the 22,000 aid trucks that remain blocked. On Saturday, August 9th, an airdropped box fell on a child in central Gaza, killing him instantly. The day before, on August 8th, an aid parcel landed on top of people and severely injured 19-year-old Karam al-Kahlout as he was trying to obtain water for his disabled father. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, standing at the teenager's bedside in the hospital, called for stopping the airdrops and instead ensure aid delivery through official crossings, quote, in a safe and organized manner, guaranteeing it reaches those in need without endangering civilians' lives. This is what we've been warning about since the Israeli occupation agreed to the Arab countries' airdrops to Gaza, Bassal stated. The Gaza government media office stated on August 9th that at least 23 Palestinians have been killed and 124 wounded from these airdrops since the beginning of the genocide. Euromed Human Rights Monitor released statistics on the exact amount of aid that has been dropped so far. From July 26th to August 11th, only 1,218 aid packages were dropped onto Gaza, the human rights group stated. Quote, Gaza's actual need is around 600 trucks of aid every single day to stop famine and begin recovery. Over 17 days, that equals to 10,200 trucks. Since one truckload equals 30 airdropped packages, Gaza requires about 18,000 packages each day. The 1,218 packages dropped in that period equal just 40.6 truckloads in total, or an average of only 2.4 trucks per day, a mere 0.4% of what is actually needed. At this rate, it would take 250 days of airdrops to deliver the same amount of aid Gaza requires in a single day, Euromed said. However, Denmark, in coordination with the United Arab Emirates and Jordan, announced that it would start participating in lethal airdrops, joining the UK, Canada, France, and Spain, among other countries who have decided to turn to public relations management instead of physically stopping Israel's genocide, starvation, and siege on Gaza. Meanwhile, Israeli forces at the Gaza boundary crossings and Israeli and American mercenary forces operating the private so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites continue to trap, injure, and kill starving Palestinians every day. Doctors Without Borders released a report this week titled, "This is not aid, this is orchestrated killing," which draws on medical data, patient testimonies, and firsthand medical witnessing, quote, to demonstrate that what has been branded as aid distribution is in fact a system of institutionalized starvation and dehumanization. Joining similar calls by Palestinian civil society and United Nations agencies, the human rights group called for the immediate dissolution of the GHF distribution mechanism and urged states and private donors to refrain from funding what is essentially a death trap. And Israeli forces continue to target starving Palestinians at crossings in northern Gaza, who try to obtain limited amount of food aid, and those who are working to protect the aid from armed Israel-backed gangs. Euromed Monitor's Maha Husseini reported on Wednesday that an Israeli airstrike targeted a group of security personnel, killing 12 and injuring dozens more. Husseini said that, quote, for weeks, aid has been looted by armed gangs operating under the protection of Israeli forces. Gangs are allowed to access areas where regular citizens are barred. Security personnel were deployed today, Wednesday, to protect aid and ensure it reached UN and international organizations' warehouses. They have now been targeted again, she said. The Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza reported on Wednesday that it recorded 8 deaths due to starvation in a 24-hour period, including 3 children. This brings the total number of victims of Israel's starvation to 235, including 106 children. Reporter Moaz Abu Taha interviewed Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah at Nasser Medical Complex this week, who talked about his 2-year-old patient, Sham Koide, who weighs just 4 kilograms, less than 9 pounds.
Sham is 2 years old. Now she's in the hospital. Her weight is just 4 kilograms. Her weight should be 12 kilograms. She lost nearly 8 kilograms from her actual weight. She's complaining from severe acute malnutrition. As we can see, she just have the skin over the bone. The muscles are lost. The fat tissue is lost. She's dehydrated. She has sunken eyes. She's apathic, she's irritable, she's anxious. She has severe distended abdomen, she has hepatomegaly. She has signs of rickets due to vitamin D deficiency, rachitic rosary, still open anterior fontanelle, irritability, wide broadening of the lower limbs and the upper limbs. So she needs to evacuate it outside as soon as possible to be diagnosed.
That was Dr. Ahmed Al-Farah at the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. Mohammed Zakout, Gaza's Director of General Hospitals, told Al Jazeera Arabic that, quote, these cases will soon be in the thousands if nothing changes. Children are among the weakest and most vulnerable to malnutrition. We have no treatments to save them, not even intravenous feeding, which is used in emergency cases like those we are seeing now. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight the story of the last date in Gaza by Asim Al-Nabih, writing from Gaza City. quote, "It's just a date, a single 4-centimeter piece of dried fruit. But here in Gaza, where nothing comes easily and everything holds meaning, even a date becomes a symbol of endurance, sacrifice, and love. I kept this date for 6 months. I'd found it and saved it for what I imagined would be the darkest days, the days when food would disappear from the shelves, when starvation would wrap itself around our lives, when sharing even a crumb would become an act of resistance. Those days are now. No one in my family wanted to eat the last date and deny someone else its sweetness. That's who we are in Gaza, not just survivors, but givers. We give even what little we have left, not because we are saints, but because love and dignity are all we can hold on to when everything else has been taken from us. War can reveal the worst in people. Here in Gaza, it also brings out the best. Our streets are filled with pain and rubble, but also with kindness. Small gestures like passing along a date speak volumes about who we are. Some may say it's just a date, but I see in it the whole of Gaza's story. Deprivation and generosity, despair and defiance, the tight knots of family and the unwillingness to surrender to cruelty. This date, saved and shared, is a tiny act of rebellion in the face of a system trying to strip us of everything, even the right to nourish our children. In Gaza, we have redefined wealth. Wealth is not what you hoard, but what you give away, and is measured in the strength of the bonds that hold families and neighbors together. In a world that tries to reduce us to statistics, we have become storytellers. A single date carries the story of a family's love, a child's survival, a father's absence, and a people's refusal to stop being human. People ask how we survive, how we keep going when the bombs keep falling, when hunger gnaws at our children, when there is no certainty that we'll live to see the next sunrise. My answer is, we survive for one another. We survive because in Gaza, no one wants to eat the last date. And we survive because we are all dreaming that a day might come soon with freedom and an abundance of dates. The date is gone now, eaten by a child too young to know what it means. But the act remains, rippling outward like a pebble cast into water. It is in these ripples, in the stories we tell, in the way we refuse to forget, that Gaza lives on. Those are excerpts from The Story of the Last Date in Gaza by Asim Annabi, writing from Gaza City on electronicintifada.net. Asim is a father, an engineer, and a PhD researcher, and serves as the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality. And finally, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. A new assessment by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the UN's Satellite Center revealed this week that 98.5% of cropland in the Gaza Strip is either destroyed in no-go zones imposed by the Israeli military, or both. Palestinians have stewarded, cared for, and made fruitful the entirety of that land for millennia, of course. But in a tiny corner of the 1.5% of land that they can still access and reclaim for food production as Israel's starvation on Gaza accelerates, members of the Samir Project, a mutual aid organization in Gaza, recorded video of an abundance of cucumber and zucchini plants, along with tomatoes, growing in the sunshine across about 2.5 acres. This was the product of a collaboration between the Samir Project and the Arab Group for the Protection of Nature, an organization that aims to protect, sustain, and reestablish sovereignty over Palestine's natural resources and food. And finally, musician and music teacher Ahmed Mouin led a song with his students, using the incessant drones overhead as instruments. The song, "Kariat Jamal Kariat," Mouin says, is a call to lift the weight of truth, the voice of courage, and the spirit that refuses to be silenced.
One, how are you? I miss you a lot, really. Today there's a lot of drones. I'm going to sing a song today with drone. شيل شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل ومن الله لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا نديلو شيل شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل ليل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل ومن الله لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا نديلو شيل شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل يا ليلو ويل ويل عالظالمي ويل ويل ومن الله لا أسهر على نجوم الليل أنا نديلو شيل شيل يا جمالي شيل يا حوطك بالله دم الشهيد معطر بالهيل.
That's amazing. Opinions you hear expressed are those of the speakers. That's Nora Barros-Friedman presenting Palestine News of the Week, found it at Flashpoints, archived at KPFA. It's a freestanding podcast, and they do some video work too, Nora Barros-Friedman and, yes, Ali Abunima from Chicago. Okay. Here's an underwriting announcement for completely different. I guess I did a disclaimer. Replay of Radio Free Labor already with a tribute to Bob Polesny. And we miss him so much.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Minuteman Press. Whether you need signs for an event, thousands of full-color flyers, or personalized promotional items, Minuteman Press can make it happen in time and on budget. They offer an extensive line of products as well as design services. Minuteman Press may be reached online